Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. Okay, fine. I appreciate David. Thank you for asking me here. I really do appreciate it. It's always good for me to get out and rub up on my fellow alcoholics, because I not only believe in the book Alcoholics Anonymous very, very seriously, I believe in the fellowship also. I think we need to stick together, and I love this format too. This is a very, very powerful format. Its focus is basically on the recovery process of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I appreciate groups that keep their focus on the solution. There are meetings today that have a lot to do with sharing and talking about what's going on in your day and expressing opinions and, you know, updating everybody on, you know, your drama du jour. And I think there's definitely a place for those meetings, and I think that they're helpful to the people that they help. But every once in a while, there's somebody who's in real trouble with alcoholism who needs a real powerful answer, and they need it soon. And it's groups like this that offer that. You know, my personal experience with alcoholism is I was drinking myself to death in a very, very quick way. There was a period of about 4 or 5 years where my drinking escalated to, I was literally drinking a large bottle of hard liquor every single night, and on the weekends, 2 or 3. I would just come to and drink myself into a blackout and pass out and come to and start drinking and put myself into a blackout. It was just ugly. It was decadent. It was painful. It was lonely. It was pitiful. I think we all understand where alcohol can really take us. There wasn't any party anymore, folks. You know, the party was long gone. I might have still been trying to find that party, but it was long gone many years ago. And I was just drinking toward the end, just for oblivion, like Bill talks about in his story. You know, 3 bottles of bathtub gin and oblivion, he says. I understand that. You know, oblivion was a good place for me. I needed to shut my head off. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I put myself into a treatment center. I put myself into an outpatient. I went to some AA meetings at the suggestion of the treatment center. I had heard about AA. I didn't know much about it. But I thought that there could possibly be an answer for me there. Maybe I can learn how to drink right, or I can stay away from alcohol. You know, so they'll teach me something. And I started going to AA, and in the middle of half measuring it, which is basically just going to meetings. That's what, I was not drinking and going to meetings. I'm gonna go off on a tangent here. One of the current Grapevines, if anybody's seen it, don't drink and go to meetings, and that's on the front cover of the Grapevine. Well, there are some people I'm very, very close to who do a lot of speaking, who are furious about that, and they're literally up at the podium with that particular Grapevine, stomping on it and burning it right from the podium, because they feel so, so strongly that that's a weak message. How I feel about it is, yes, don't drink and go to meetings. That's a great goal. But please let somebody know that if they're an alcoholic, they don't have the power to do that. They need a power greater than themselves to be able to pull that off. You can't just tell a newcomer, here, don't drink and go to meetings. Yeah, it'd be like Nancy Reagan's just say no. You know, oh, you bought an 8-ball of Coke? Why don't you just say no? You know, that doesn't even compute for alcoholics. You're trying to stop a semi with a cobweb with that stuff. So I show up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm in Basking Ridge and Bernersville, New Jersey, AA, in the late 80s. And what that was about was there was meeting based sobriety going on in this area. What do I mean by that? Well, sponsorship had a lot to do with encouraging you not to drink and go to meetings. Hey, I'll see you tomorrow night at the meeting. Here's my phone number. Let's go get coffee. It was very fellowship oriented and it was very supportive, but there wasn't a lot of the recovery piece of the triangle. Sponsors didn't bring you over to their house to take you through the steps. That was unheard of back in the 80s. So I landed in these meetings, and I was truly trying to treat my alcoholism with therapy-esque AA meetings. And I was going out of my mind. And if you're truly alcoholic and you don't get a spiritual answer, a spiritual experience, if you're really alcoholic, and most people in current AA today really don't qualify to the big book description of an alcoholic, and that's fine. But if you're one of those people that are, and you try to address your alcoholism with meeting attendance, one of three things will happen. You'll go crazy and end up in an asylum. You will take your own life because alcoholics are 60 times more likely to take their own life with suicide than non-alcoholics. That's why they ask you that question. The actuaries ask you that question on your life insurance policies because it's an important warning sign for them. Or you will drink again because you will not be able to take the psychic pain of sobriety. Sobriety will become untenable if not accompanied by some type of life-shifting, life-changing process. And I found that out in a very strange way. I'm going to meetings like a maniac. I recognize that there are people that supposedly drank like I did, and they're sober today and they're happy. You know, okay, I you got to believe 50 of them. You know, so I know that there's some kind of answer in AA, and I'm just doubling down on my meetings. I'm hearing people share at meetings, you know, I had a really terrible day yesterday, so I'm going to two meetings today. So, you know, I was like, you know, doubling down. I was going like 13 meetings a week. And yet, what was going on? This is typical. I'd be sitting in a meeting. This is like 6-10 months sobriety. Sitting in a meeting, and I'm sitting there, you know, like, how you doing, Chris? Oh, I'm doing great, you know, and somebody be sharing, and I'd be thinking, what a pompous ass this guy is. I can't believe it. Just listen, what a hypocrite. What a piece full of crap this guy. And then I'd see somebody raise their hand, and I'd go, no, don't. You know, I'd be thinking this, don't call on him. God, I don't need to hear his crap one more time. Oh, they called on him. Oh, now he's going to share about his family. Oh, my God, please just kill me now. I can't believe it. And this is what's going on in my head. Sitting in the meetings that I understand I need to be embracing for my survival. I have an alcoholic mindset. I've got the alcoholism all over me. Now, what I was hearing at meetings, now I don't blame this on the people at the meetings. They were, all of them were trying to help me. And a lot of times it's not the transmitter that's at fault, it's the receiver. A lot of times we hear things that people don't say, or we don't hear the things that we should be hearing. You know, it's just the way we are. And I was hearing things that related to just me not drinking. I didn't take a drink today, so I'm a winner. The first step for me is I just don't drink. Even if my ass falls off, I'm not going to take a drink. And I was hearing a lot of this stuff, which would make me believe that alcohol is my problem, right? Like, isn't alcohol my problem? Alcohol is not my problem. Alcohol is my solution. And let me tell you why alcohol is my solution. All right, in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, in the doctor's opinion, it talks about us being restless, irritable, and discontented. Anybody in here? Now, we're talking about sober, like, you know, maybe you're a week sober. Anybody in here relate to restless, irritable, and discontent? Oh my God, yes. Let the record show that all 100 people here tonight raised their hand. That is a good day for an unrecovered alcoholic, restless, irritable, and discontent. A normal day is prey to misery, depression, anxiety, self-centered fear, guilt, remorse, shame, just completely uncomfortable with yourself and your environment. You just want to be anywhere but here. I just want to go back to my house, go up to my room and pull the covers over my head. I can't deal with this. That's like a normal day for us. And a bad day is pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Care, frustration, bewilderment, and despair. You know, that's us on a bad day. Sober. So here I am. Here I am in my last year of drinking. I come to in the morning wearing the clothes that I passed out in the night before, reeking of either vodka or bourbon, reeking. It's just coming out of my pores. And I'll stagger into the bathroom and, you know, do my vomiting calisthenics, you know, throw some water on my face, go out to my car and go off to my terrible job. I was a bad electrician for a real bad contractor. And, you know, and the whole time I'm driving to work, I mean, if I would have gotten pulled over, I would have blown a 5-0. I mean, and I hadn't had a drink in like 12 hours, you know, because I passed out at 8 o'clock the night before, you know, because I drank a quart of whiskey in 2 hours. So I'd be swearing to God that I don't ever want to feel like this again. You know, they used to lie to me. They used to say that I had a hangover. It wasn't a hangover. If you're 130 pounds and you drink a quart of vodka in 2 hours, you're not going to wake up with a hangover. You're going to wake up with alcohol poisoning. That's what I was doing to myself. Every single night I was suffering from alcohol poisoning because I overloaded my system with ethyl alcohol. And the next morning I would just be ringing. I'd be poisoned. And I'd go off to work and I would feel terrible. And I would say, you know, today's the day. Today's the day. I'm not drinking anymore. I'm giving it up and today's the day. And if you would have strapped a lie detector onto me, the needle would have gone right to true. This guy's telling the truth. You can put money on it. He's never going to drink again. But what would happen is I'd get half a sandwich down around lunchtime. I'd rehydrate. You know how you have to drink about a gallon of liquid, you know, to get hydrated again. And I'd start to feel just this much human. And on the way home, I would say, you know what? That not drinking decision I made this morning, you know, that was pretty rash. That was, we might have to modify that decision a little bit. You know, as a matter of fact, we probably should stop at the liquor store on the way home. And what happened was I had a sane decision in the morning. That was very sane, to not poison yourself. Is a very, very sane decision. To never poison yourself again is a very sane decision. What happened was I became insane as the day went on. The obsession of the mind grabbed me, and I had no choice. I was going to the liquor store. Now, why was alcohol my solution? Because of the way I felt. I remember this one time I went into the liquor store and I knew right where my Gordon's vodka was or my George Dickel bourbon. And I made sure that the liquor store guy never ran out. You know, we had an understanding. And I knew right where it was and I would get it and I'd put the money down. And as I was walking out to the car, I would go like, ah, you know. But this one day there was a lady in line. And she was asking questions. And I'm waiting. I need to buy this vodka. And I need to get home. And this lady is like, you know what kind of wine goes with tilapia? You know, she's talking to the guy who's supposed to be checking me out. And I'm like, are you crazy? Who cares what kind of wine? You got a vodka buyer here. You know, move that lady out of the way. Who cares, you know? And he's talking to her. He's going, well, you know, there's this Chablis from, you know, the vineyards sections of California that has a nice blush. And I'm like, nobody can get the hell out of her. Give her a bottle of Gallo and get her the hell out of the way. I got a problem here. I'm sober. And she's keeping me from my alcohol. I got a problem. Now, does that sound like alcohol is my problem? My problem is the restlessness, the irritability, the self-centered fear, the anxiety, the not being comfortable with myself and my environment. I have a spiritual malady. I'm spiritually ill. I am not comfortable with myself and my environment. And now this is funny. When I first started drinking, they were called spirit shops. Liquor stores were called spirit shops. Now, what is the treatment for alcoholism? a spiritual awakening, what do we almost kill ourselves with? Spirits. It's funny that those two things are so close. Now, what did I find in the bottle? I found ease and comfort in that bottle until I became a vomiting pig. I found ease and comfort. And when I had about three or four drinks, I could just do this. You know? And that's what I was looking for. That's what I was obsessed with. And that's what I needed. Now, you take that booze away from me, and what do you got? You got somebody who's stark raving sober, going to 13 meetings a day, a week, wanting to kill people. That's what you got. Now, how I discovered the solution, to my problem was, a friend of mine had some tapes. He used to be this guy who would go to New Age bookstores and buy all kinds of books on pyramids and Course in Miracles. I mean, every week it was something different. And this one day he handed me a stack of tapes. There was 8 90-minute tapes. And I go, what is that? He goes, oh, there's a couple of guys from Arkansas doing a big book study. I'm like, what? 8 90-minute tapes. I did the math. That's 12 hours of listening to somebody from Arkansas. You know what I mean? Oh, my God. Who would want to do that? They probably talk like this. But I promised the guy that I would listen to these. And I had a long ride to work, so I started listening to them. And they were the late, great Joe and Charlie, who truly, truly saved my life, these Arkansas guys. What they told me was, is they told me what my problem was. My problem was spiritual. It reflected alcohol, but it also reflected a lot of other aspects. There was a lot of aspects to the illness alcoholism. And they talked about the solution to alcoholism as it's laid out in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, around this area in the late 80s, you had step meetings out the gazoo. You had speaker meetings and you had discussion meetings. Those were the main meetings. There was one big book meeting in Wachung that was like three towns away from me, and every once in a while I'd go to it, but they read every single word out of that big book. I mean, so you'd be in the stories three quarters of the time because they'd read every single page of the book. It wasn't a 164 meeting. It was like, you know, I was an idiot too, and we're going to be on that story for 3 weeks, you know, way in the back of the book. So I didn't know anything about big book recovery until I heard these tapes. And basically what those tapes told me was, Chris, if you're not following the instructions in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you're not working the steps. If you're not working the steps, you're not working our solution, our program of recovery. And if you're not doing that, don't even pretend that you have a program. Don't share that you've got a program. Don't say, well, when I came into the program, don't say any of that crap. Because a program is working the steps out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'd like to say I jumped right into the work. That's really not true. I got a big resentment against people from Arkansas. Basically, because if I was to believe Joe and Charlie, then everybody I was going to meetings with was wrong. How are you going to do that? How are you going to do that? My sponsor, who I love, is wrong? I put those tapes to the shelf and I said, maybe that's how they do it in Arkansas, but in New Jersey, we share. Now, what happened was what I told you earlier. If you don't address your alcoholism with a spiritual recovery solution, one of three things is going to happen. You're going to drink, you're going to go insane, or you're going to kill yourself. Those are your three options if you don't have a spiritual experience. If you can just stay sober without a spiritual solution, you are not an alcoholic the way this book is part of the description of this alcoholic in this book. This book says that you will not make it without a vital spiritual experience. And you're not going to get a vital spiritual experience by going to meetings. And you're not going to get it from service commitments. You're going to only get it from the transformational process of the 12 steps. So, So I put the tapes to the side. Now I really hate people from Arkansas. But what happened was life caught up with me, real life, stark, raving, sober life. And I lost my job. A state caught up with me because I did, I fled to avoid prosecution. And they caught up with me. And, my girlfriend broke up with me. And, you know, just a whole bunch of stuff happened in a couple of week period of time. And I broke down. And I had a sober bottom, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. I had a mental breakdown, you know. And I remember going over to my, I so wanted to drink. And I went over to my sponsor's house and I knocked on the door. This was unusual for me. I never would just show up unannounced to my sponsor's house. It was not done. And I'm knocking on the door and he comes out. And I go, Phil, and I couldn't talk. I was so emotionally devastated about all this stuff. I couldn't even talk. And I remember he brought me in and he sat me down and he talked about praying and he talked about the spiritual solution and everything. And basically what I did was I went back home and very, very soon after that, I pulled these tapes back off the shelf. I dusted off my big book, I got some paper and a pen and I got to work. There was nobody, you know, in 1990 who was going to take you through the steps in Somerset County that I knew of. I did it with the Joe and Charlie tapes and a big book and some paper. And I did, you know, maybe it was even a half-assed job, but I did what I did. And those actions started to contribute to the healing of my spirit. I didn't even know that that was what would happen at the time. I certainly didn't make this decision out of any sense of virtue. I just didn't want to feel bad anymore. And I knew if I put alcohol in my body, I'd be dead real quick. So, you know, but I had to have something. I couldn't exist the way I was existing with the anxiety and everything. So I started to work the steps. Now, what happened is, you know, I was going to a lot of meetings where you share. And I learned how to give good share. And all of a sudden, I start to heal. I start to get more comfortable. And that's noticeable to the people in the meetings. They're like, Chris, you know, you've changed, you know, you really seem to be doing good. And I started to get a whole bunch of sponsees. And, you know, back then there was a lot of one-liners. You know, I got to tell you, the best thing that I could tell you if you're a new alcoholic is this book here is a bullshit sifter. There is so much crap out there in the meetings that makes no sense and has no real applicability to a spiritual solution in your life. It's stuff that's come in from bad treatment, bad therapy, and bad self-help books. You know, and it's all over the place in Alcoholics Anonymous. If there's one thing I could tell you is, you know, become comfortable with, become knowledgeable with the first 164 pages, especially up through working with others. And use that as your foundation. Use that as the template to move through your recovery work, because it's so potent and it's so powerful. And there's so much other crap. You know, I was looking at the sponsorship pamphlet over there. Personally, I don't believe there's been a decent piece of literature published since the early 50s. Okay, and like Living Sober and the sponsorship pamphlet. They go contrary to what the big book says. They go flat ass contrary to what it says. So you have to, and a lot of things that you hear in the meetings are very contrary to a real strong recovery program. You need to be discerning. You should be the person of consideration. There's three types of people that I've met in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's the pious person. That was this guy that gave me the tapes. To be pious is, you know, whatever book you just read. Oh, The Power of Now. You know, oh, it's all in The Power of Now. You know, you're pious. You're gonna buy practically anything. You know, if you hear it in a meeting two or three times, it's true for you. You know, that's piety. Then there's the bigot. The bigot is, my sponsor, Harvey Gerbil Feather, taught me five things in 1952, and that's all I need. That's the person who's got a closed mind and is not going to be open to any new information. Thank you. You know, I was told to not drink and go to meetings, and that's what I'm doing, and I'm keeping it simple. That's the bigot. The person who's got the best chance of recovering on Alcoholics Anonymous is the person of consideration. Even the big book says you need to ask yourself what spiritual terms mean to you. You need to ask yourself what this stuff is going to mean to you. Now, what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that's really kind of amazing is it's unbelievably simple. It's so simple that we don't believe that it could possibly be that simple. There was a great speaker out in California who was really influential. He completely changed the speaker podium paradigm. Until this guy got up in front of the microphone, most people would tell drunk logs. And all of a sudden, Chuck Chamberlain gets up and he starts talking about spiritual solutions. He became beloved because what he would put in front of you had substance, it had depth, and it had weight. And there was one thing that he said almost every time he spoke. Said, folks, you're alcoholic. There is only one problem that you have. And within that problem are all other problems. And there is one solution, and within that solution are all of your other solutions. Now, the one problem is what's happened with you is you have separated from God. You are experiencing separation from God. That's your one problem. And all your other problems can be equated to that one problem. And your one solution is connection to God, conscious contact with God. And within that solution are all your other solutions. Now, in some way, we all believe that. You know, that resonates with us because it's very, very true. But then we'll go to a meeting and we'll raise our hand, we'll talk about the divorce. Well, wait a minute. You know, really, we should be talking about separation from God, or we should be talking about the solution, connection to God. That's how simple it should be, but it's not that simple. For 2,000 years, people in South America and people in Africa would eat monkey meat, right? So that they would hunt monkeys. Now, they learned pretty quickly a real surefire way to catch monkeys. And here's what they would do. They would take an earthenware jug, a heavy earthenware jug with a certain diameter top, just enough so that the monkey can get its hand down into it, and they would put food in the jars that the monkeys would eat. And what would happen is the monkeys would reach down their hand into the jars, and they would grab the food, but they couldn't get their hand out because there's now food in their hand, all right? And the hunters would come up and just come up and clobber them over the head and take them off and cook them up. Now, the monkeys would be freaking out, you know, knowing that there's somebody coming to kill them, but they would not let go of that food. That's what we do. We don't let go of our old ideas. We don't let go of self-destructive character defects. And you know what? We take them all the way to the gates of insanity and death, hanging on to these things. It is so simple. You've got a problem, you know, let go, let God. You've heard it all, right? There's a terrible situation that's going on. Well, you know, let go, you know, detach from, you know, the emotional entanglement of all. It's so simple that we find it incredibly difficult to do. Intellectually, we can understand that we should be letting go of this, but you don't understand. This is my job. You know, I've got to be a maniac, you know, to be able to perform. And we come up with all this different reasoning and everything. Recovery from alcoholism is more about letting go than it is about learning new tricks. It's about discarding more than it's about acquiring. Because we come in here with so much baggage. In step two, I'm basically told in step two that I need to come to believe that there's a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity. And believe me, we're insane, not in certain ways, but we're we're certainly not of sound mind when we show up here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've been poisoning ourselves with alcohol. We've been ruining relationships that we don't want to ruin. We've been self-destructive in 35 different ways. And we haven't been able to separate from alcohol, even though somewhere deep down inside we recognize that we must. We can't. So, you know, we're not really sane. Now, a lot of different people are going to tell you there's different solutions than God. They're going to tell you that a 28-day treatment center is a solution. They'll tell you that an outpatient is a solution. They'll tell you medication is a solution. They'll tell you that therapy is a solution. They'll tell you that going to 90 meetings in 90 days is a solution. A lot of people will be handing you these solutions because the real solution is too simple for them to believe, which is coming to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore sanity. It's just too, it's, it can't possibly be that easy. Well, you know, I've studied the book Alcoholics Anonymous a lot, and without exaggeration, I can easily say I've been through this book 400 times. Whether it was a big book workshop, taking somebody through the steps, studying on my own, listening to workshops on tape, I guarantee it's at least 400 times. And every time I go through it, I pick up on new stuff. Well, one of the last times I went through the book, I wanted specifically to look at Bill Wilson's descriptions of and adjectives of God. I wanted to look at every reference to God he had in here. And I came up with something fascinating, for me at least. Bill Wilson's conception of God was not a noun. God was not a being up in heaven that could be grasped. Bill Wilson's conception of God was more of a power. Father of light, you know, a power greater than ourselves. He believed in a spiritual power that could work in you and through you if you got the right relationship with it through the right spiritual exercises. That you could actually harness this power. This harnessing is probably a bad word. This power would be able to work in you and through you. You could place yourself in the sunlight of the Spirit through spiritual practices. Being in the sunlight of the Spirit, God could beam down on you and heal you and help with character defects and the obsession to drink and everything else if you remain in that sunlight of the Spirit. You always, though, need to know that you are not the sun. So step two, I can easily grasp because it's not religious dogma. It's not a conception of God that I had in Sunday school. It's more about spiritual power, harnessing the spiritual power of the universe. And many of us call that power God. In step three, I had to make a decision. I had to make a decision. And my decision was a little bit crazy, but it says in our literature that God does not make too hard terms for those who seek him. The hoop that you have to jump through is larger than you think. And I started to read a lot of books. I started to read The Road Less Traveled. And I started to read The Sermon on the Mount. And I started the way a lot of us start with some of the very popular spiritual books that you find people recommending in recovery. And I've never stopped. I've probably read 2,000 spiritual books in my day. I find comfort in it. I think I need to seek God. I need to seek God. And I need to prepare myself for the power by working the steps and following these spiritual principles. And that's really my step two and my step three. We prepare ourselves by an inventory. We need to look at where we're angry, where we're afraid, and our conduct. Now, I used to think that's a little bit simple, you know, oh, that's pretty good, but I've had deeper therapy, you know. Well, think about it. Our anger and, you know, our resentment, our fear and our anxiety, and our guilt and shame and remorse over our conduct, that's the Megillah, okay? That's why I needed to go to the liquor store and hope there's not some lady in front of me who wants to talk to the cashier. I needed out of all of that stuff. And what would happen is in drunken stupors, I would cause more problems that would cause more resentments, more fear, and I'd behave abominably, and it would give me more guilt, shame, and remorse. It was a never ending cycle. So I need to inventory my behavior, because I have to start acting spiritual. For me to be able to participate in the maintenance of my spiritual condition and stay in the sunlight of the Spirit, I need to be acting spiritual. Otherwise, I'm not going to be in that light. So in the fourth step, I identify the main causes and conditions of my failure at life. I inventory all of the people, institutions, and principles I've been angry at, all of my fears. I look at especially my sexual relationships, but all of my close, intimate relationships I need to look at in the conduct inventory. Then I need to put together a path forward. We put together a sex ideal. I've gone further than that. I've put together work ideals, family ideals, husband ideals, all kinds of stuff like that. I've put the attributes of those, and then, in a prayer regime, I ask God to fit me and to mold me into these ideals, because I believe those ideals are spiritual ideals. In the fifth step, I share all this stuff with somebody. I've got to come out of the dark. Folks, I really thought I was like this scumbag, and I thought if you just knew what I've done and what I think in my head, you wouldn't have anything to do with me. And that was part of my alcoholic isolation. Remember, my main problem is isolation from God, but it's also isolation from man and from myself. So sharing all this stuff, it's like blowing up that spot, because when I share the absolute darkest crannies of my past with somebody, they usually go, "That's not so bad. I did that too." And hearing something like that brings me out of the shadows. And all of a sudden I feel, really, I'm not a bad guy. I was a pretty good guy doing bad things, and I was a pretty smart guy doing stupid things. And right now I'm on a path of recovery. I'm trying to improve my life. I'm trying to improve how I comport myself in this world, how I treat other people. I'm trying to improve this. I've got to lighten up on myself a little bit. And step six and seven, I now understand the power of God, because the power of God has pulled me away from the alcoholic abyss. I no longer drink alcohol, which is amazing for me, because I had the obsession. I couldn't stay away from alcohol for 24 hours. I'm now sober. I'm sober by the grace of God. I'm sober through that power. That power is working in me and through me and keeping me away from a drink. It talks in the 10th step where we're safe and protected. So I need to use that same power on my character defects. I've got a huge amount of character defects. In step six, I become willing to have God remove these defects of character. In step seven, I humbly ask God to remove these defects of character. And, sometimes that's pretty tough. That's pretty tough to do, because we don't believe it's that simple. We're complicated people. There's a great story. I think it's in The Power of Now. It's in one of those books. It talks about this little kid, little Joey. And Joey gets a toothache. He's about 10 years old, and he gets a toothache, and his tooth is killing him. And he knows he's got a game the next day, and, he's really worried about it. And he knows he's had toothaches before, and he's gone to his mother. And his mother's crushed up some aspirin, given him some aspirin, and, the toothache has gone away. And he knows if he goes to his mother, he'll get that aspirin, he'll get that treatment, and the toothache will go away. Well, he doesn't do that. He waits until finally it's like 9 o'clock at night and he can't sleep, and then he goes into his mother's room and, I have my tooth. Now, the tooth started hurting about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Why didn't Joey go to his mother to get the aspirin at 4 o'clock in the afternoon? Well, it's because he knew that he would get the aspirin, the pain would go away, but the next day, a phone call would be placed to Dr. Mengele, the dentist. And he'd go to Dr. Mengele, and the doctor wouldn't stop with that one tooth problem. He'd find three or four other things. And there'd be drills and suction cups and blood and styrofoam and, you know, spitting in the cup and all this kind of stuff that he didn't want to do. So that's why he didn't go to his mother. He was just hoping that it would go away. Because he didn't want to go through that the next day. He knew that once he goes to the dentist, he's going to walk out with perfect teeth. And he just didn't want to deal with that at this point in time. Well, isn't that the way we are? We come into Alcoholics Anonymous and we share, you know, or we talk to our sponsor about the big problem. Well, let's start working the steps. Let's start turning our will and our lives over to the care of God. Let's start inventorying our problems. No. We don't want to do that. We don't want to be perfect. We just want to get out of the jackpot. We want the pain to stop. You know what I mean? We don't want to go through all that work. Well, we're just like little Joey. I found that there's a promise in the book. God will bring you to such much more wonderful place than anything you could have imagined yourself. And that's the way my life is today. And it's not like I tried to improve the condition of my life, because when I used to do that, when I used to try to improve the condition of my life, you know, by making more money or getting better girlfriends or, you know, whatever I thought I needed, I blew my spot up. What I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is, as ex-problem drinkers, our very lives depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may meet their needs. You know, we must be thinking of other people above ourselves. We need to be available to be helpful to other people. And by doing that, all this stuff has been added to my life. My life is incredible today. And you never could have convinced me that by concentrating more on helping other people, my life would get better. It doesn't make any sense. But it does make sense in the spiritual world. Now, you want some of these character defects to be removed. Obviously, some of them are killing you. Some of them are just annoying you. But you start to recognize that these are barricades to fulfillment in your life. You start to see that when you're doing your six and your seven step work. The best possible atmosphere to be in for the removal of character defects is to become willing to make direct amends to the people and institutions that your character defects have harmed, and actually go out and make amends to the people and the institutions that your character defects have harmed. I want to tell a quick story that'll highlight this. I was working with a guy around here. He was kind of rough guy. He was a Mason, you know, and he grew up in the city, and he had a pretty rough personality. And he came in, and he was my sponsor, and we were working together, and you know, he was working hard. I mean, he really wanted sobriety. We really wanted a recovery, but he had a long way to go because he was coming from such a far place. But anyway, this one day we're coming out of a 7-Eleven, and as we're going out, I see him do this. You know, before he walked out the door, he grabbed a pack of cigarettes on the way out and put it in his pocket. And I'm outside. I'm like, dude, man, you stole a pack of cigarettes. And he's like, what? I'm going, I saw you grab the cigarettes on the way out. He's like, no. He's like, that's in the front. I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, that's in the front. They put the displays out there. They expect a certain amount of stuff to be stolen from there. They budget for it. You're a chump if you don't take that stuff. I'm like, no. You stole a bag of cigarettes. You know, we need to look at this. So we started to look at this. I had him inventory it. He went all the way up through the inventory. He's in the eighth step. And he really was willing to go to any lengths. So he recognized that he had been stealing his whole life. He was doing pretty well because he had a good business. He put a bunch of envelopes together, like 40 envelopes together with lots of money in each one. And he went around to every 7-Eleven he can remember stealing from and asked for the manager, handed the manager the money, and did his deal, did his amends. Now, let me just ask you this question. Do you think he still steals after going through all that? I don't think so. I don't think so. These amends are the best possible atmosphere we can place ourselves in for the removal of the character defects we're making amends for. It's incredibly powerful. You know, but we want to buy a self-help book and we want to read ourselves better. You know, the fact of the matter is we're alcoholics and there's a bunch of work we need to do. Step 10 is all the spiritual principles of step 1 through 9 and steps 11 and 12 all put together in a reactive package. How do you walk through the day? What tools do you need to use? What spiritual tools do you need to use in what situations? And step 10 really is practicing the principles in all of our affairs all the time. Step 11 is seeking with prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. Listen, there's wonderful statements in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The consciousness of the presence of God will become the most important thing in your life. We seek through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. The consciousness of the presence of God. The conscious contact with God. God working in us and through us. You know, look at some of the 10-step promises. Look at some of the 12-step promises. This program of Alcoholics Anonymous is about harnessing the power of God in your life. I mean, holy... You know, the main thing I like to do in Alcoholics Anonymous is shout the good news. Go around to different speaking commitments, share at different meetings, and shout the good news. This is a powerful, powerful body of work. This is about harnessing the power of God in your life. What can you not do when you've got the power of God rolling through you? So in step 11, I've been really diligent about this. I do my prayer and meditation. I used to just do it in the morning and at night. I do it like anytime I'm not doing something, you know, I'm praying. It's like, I read a spiritual book one time that talks about St. Paul saying, pray without ceasing. That was his instruction. Pray without ceasing. Pray all the time. But, you know, we're enjoying God's cathedral and God's children. You know, we're always in the cathedral. You know, I'm conscious of that presence on an ongoing basis today. And whatever I can do to grow in understanding and effectiveness as far as the spiritual life, I do. I used to read fiction. The 70s and 80s, that's all I did is I read science fiction. Just take me out of here right now. You know, today it's mainly about nonfiction spiritual books. You know, some history, but, you know, probably 60% of the books that I read have to do with spiritual practices. Buddhism. You know, I just got done a big long study on Hinduism, which is very cool. I'm a Christian and I believe in the Christian principles, but I'm also inclusive. You know, I'm not exclusive, I'm inclusive. You know, whatever path to God you have, as long as you're on that path and that resonates true with you, then it's good. You know, we don't, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't tell you what type of God to believe in. We tell you that you need to believe in God or you're not going to make it, you know, but it's broad, it's roomy, it's all inclusive. It's never exclusive or forbidden. There's room enough for all of us on this playing field and all beliefs, as long as they have some spiritual sustenance. Step 12, the first 11 steps prepare us for step 12. Step 12 is everything. Having had a spiritual awakening, which is the treatment for alcoholism, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the first 11 steps, we tried to carry this message. What message? The message of the first 11 steps to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all of our affairs. Bear down on step 10. Practice these principles. I had to practice them today. I'm involved in union negotiations where I work. A union works for me. And it's gotten really ugly because the CBA came up and I had to terminate somebody. And it's just really, really ugly. And the logbook from the termination period disappears. It's gone. Right? Immediately, my first thought is, who would have taken it except the union to do something to help this you know union member's case, like to hide the evidence or whatever. I mean, I couldn't understand why it would be gone. So I made some trouble. I basically said, look, what's going to happen is if it doesn't turn up in the next couple of days, there's going to be a polygraph guy is going to come in. Everybody's going to have to take a lie detector test because this is our client's book. It's a legal document. It's not our property. We have to do everything we possibly can to find it. You know, whoever took it, as long as it's back by Monday, no questions asked, I'm not going to worry about it. Well, it's not back by Monday, and I'm starting to get pissed. And my assistant goes, Chris, can I just look through your office one more time? But guess what? It's in one of my drawers, all right? And I've made all kinds of trouble. Now, do I like apologizing? Do I like making amends and explaining to people that I was wrong? And what can I do to make this right? Especially with union members that I'm in conflict with. Do I want to do that? Absolutely not. Every fiber of my being is saying, screw them. They broke into my office and put it back in there just to make me look bad. You know, because I didn't remember putting it there. So, but I knew that there's a set of tools that I have to use because I'm an alcoholic. Every single one of those guys I sat down today and I made direct amends to them because I found the book was found in my office. And after the last amends that I made with them, I can't tell you how much better I felt. Oh my God, you know, all that tension and conflict that was happening with the union negotiations and everything. I'm unattached to it emotionally. You know, it's going to be what it's going to be. I'll handle it however it is, but I'm not emotionally attached to it anymore. Does this stuff work? Oh my God. It's not only is it the only answer if you're really an alcoholic, it's the best deal you'll ever get. You know, this work is overpayment. You know, it's overpayment. We not only recover from alcoholism, but we get an incredibly fruitful life if we continue to practice these principles. And that's a pretty good deal. You know, alcoholism is a progressively fatal illness. And, you know, the treatment for alcoholism is a spiritual awakening. You know, that's a pretty good deal. You know, the treatment for herpes is not, you know, a spiritual awakening. The treatment for pancreatic cancer is not to know a new freedom and a new happiness. You know what I mean? Here we are alcoholics, and I believe that we're lucky. And this all goes back to we used to go to the spirit store because we had a spiritual void in us. And we filled that with alcohol, with sex, with drugs, with whatever we could fill it with. And temporarily, it even sometimes worked. What we are is we're walking around with a spiritual void as an unrecovered alcoholics, and we need to fill that with spirit. And steps 1 through 12 are filling the spiritual void one-on-one. And that's about all I got tonight, guys. Thank you. I hope that was about 45 minutes. I probably went longer. So is now Stump the Chump? Is that what it is now, David? Okay. Anybody have anything to share or any questions? Please just jump in. Yes.
This is Peter. You just have an internet on it. You just connect with your story. And it makes me want to do this sense. I mean, I was sick on 4 right now, and I'm like halfway through, so I just want to treat that. So when I go home, I'm going to do that, and then I'll fix it. I like to be so upset. It's make me spiritually good, I feel, so. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. I'm still an alcoholic. So thank you very much. That just covered the whole terrain in a nutshell. It was really good. the most important thing here was a practical example of the union negotiation. I mean, the union issue, the book, the logbook. That's really where the rubber meets the road, is in the practical application every day. And the way it works, I've found in my paltry time here, having done this work, is mind-numbing, is the only way I can put it. I mean, I'm more astounded more of the time. And I apply it in every single thing I do in my practice, in what I do for a living. My relationships with my secretary, my relationship with clients, my relationship with people I deal with on the outside, is informed and enhanced by this program. So where I used to walk into a situation standing before someone who I knew was going to judge me, that's one of my biggest fears, being judged. I used to tremble inside. I used to get in warrior mode and tremble inside. Now I go in and I pray before I go in. And I'm using the steps. And when I go in, I'm at peace. And somehow the person who's going to judge me picks up on the fact that I'm at peace. And somehow that results in an outcome which isn't always in my favor, but in the long run, it works out for the best. And more often than not, I walk out having left an impression of someone who's not wound up like a lock spring, someone who has actually made an argument that sounds like a legitimate argument, and has just let it go. I didn't have to beat the horse to death. And as far as getting over my self-loathing is concerned, peeling away the onions, you know, takes you to another place. I mean, I thought I had covered everything, and one day I found out that all the fears that I had listed in my fear inventory were not really my fear. That there was one that I had left out and I had to deal with. And that was a very, very difficult thing for me to figure out. Now that I understand it, and I'll, you know, it's just really, it's a fear of being beaten up. And I had this fear of being beaten up. It stood as an entity unto itself. Say, oh, that's really this kind of fear, that kind of fear. The fear of being beaten up, which came from my childhood, and carried through my entire body. Now, what am I going to do with this thing? I mean, I have this fear, it resides inside me. What am I going to do with it? How is my higher power going to take this away from me? Did he take it away yet? Did he take it away yet? Did he take it away yet? And the answer is yes. Gradually. Praying on it every day. I pray in the morning, I pray for everybody else I know, and I pray for myself to do it. And that's the process of turning it over. And it is that simple.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to therapy for the next 500 years, and it only will complicate it. But it is that simple, and it does work.
You know, the change that happens when you achieve recovery, it's really, you know, it's an experience that you just don't want to miss. One of the things with alcoholism that makes it such a tricky illness is, how do you know what you don't know? Now, many people who come through the doors in AA, they're so sick, they don't even really know how sick they are. There is one thing that's always true of people that walk through that door when they're new. They're in way more trouble than they think they are. You know, that's always true. Alcoholism is more aggressive and more all-encompassing than they're giving it credit for. The other thing that's true that many of them miss and blow out of here before they even get an understanding of is Alcoholics Anonymous is a larger answer than you're going to give it credit for when you walk through the door. You're just not going to believe that you can know a new attitude and a new outlook on life. That there'll be a complete shift in your behavior and your perception, and you know, the quality of your life is going to multiply by 100. Your life has pretty much sucked for a long, long time. You just don't see any light at the end of the tunnel. So you're in more trouble than you think you are, but there's a bigger answer here than you think you are. I thank God every day that I stayed here long enough to catch alcoholism, you know, and I stayed here long enough to recover from it. Many, many people don't get that opportunity. If I had a dollar for everybody that blew through our meetings, the meetings that I've gone to over the years, and stayed for a week, a month, a year, and then left, you know, without going through the steps, and then went back to drinking or whatever, went back to a dysfunctional dry life, if I had a dollar for every one of those people, I'd be wealthy now. And there are probably 10 million people out there today in North America walking around with the idea that Alcoholics Anonymous does not work, because they went to it and they found no solution. I believe that you need to put enough into AA to be able to get enough back from AA to be able to stay to find the recovery process. And many people just sit in the seats. They sit in the seats and they expect something from osmosis. And when they don't get it, they go away. And, you know, in their own mind, rightfully so, there's no real answer here. You know, people are just complaining. All I hear is people bitching about shit. And, you know, and then they go. So there's, at last, the last statistics that I saw is, that there's basically 30 million alcoholics in North America today. And there's between 2 and 3 million sober in AA. You know, I would say probably most of those 30 million have come through here. Or been exposed to us somehow, some way, maybe briefly, maybe long term. But there's only, at any given time, there's only between 2 and 3 million people in the rooms. So I'm grateful that I stuck around long enough. And you know what? There's a renaissance going on. I know David's been part of this for a long time. Many of us have. There's a renaissance going on about getting back to the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous. We were in the weeds for decades. Anybody that was around in the 70s or 80s know that we were in the weeds, man. It was the wounded inner child, or it was, you know, the meetings were about anything and everything, and we were in the weeds. And there's a renaissance now of people that are bringing us back to the simplicity and the basics of the primary foundational work that we need to be involved in, and go get with those people. And if somebody is talking to you about some meeting and they say, oh, those guys are big book Nazis over there, stay away from them, find out who they're talking about and go. You know what I mean? Because usually they're going to be people who are talking solution and practicing solution. And if you're in real trouble with alcoholism, you're going to die if you don't. You know, many, many, many people come in here before they're what's described in this book as a real alcoholic. They come in here as a potential or a heavy drinker or whatever, and that is the way it should be. They may not need to engage in a recovery solution. Their solution might actually be not drinking, but the alcoholic is just gonna shake to spiritual pieces without some type of body of spiritual work to engage in. You know, we're not gonna be happy people.
You've gotten smart to attend a it's funny, I must have had an alcoholic mind to tell a story about this book, all the things that you didn't pay off the secretary, what you found at the price you gave you with the back of your arm.
Could have been.
but not attachment, right? So you talk about how it behaves between a lot of love and you de-evolve, you deconstructed Chuck's basic theme, right? Because you have one problem and put that stem all the other problems in there. Oh my God, what a wonderful deconstruct and integration. And you spoke so vividly of Bill Wilson's photoelectric constructs with reference to God all throughout chapter 1 and goosebumps, because that's even the nail on the head. That's exactly the photoelectric construct. And that's exactly what it is. You talk about power of God in our lives, right? And I just realized this recently, you know, I discovered for me, this is the great secret, is if I'm fortunate enough to get you guys coming into my life, quite simply what happens, right? But there's no prayer in our book, as you say, and I've heard people say, there's no, dear God, please help me not drink today prayer. It's not there. Third, fourth, seventh, and in the other book, the 11-step prayer. Every prayer we have, God, please help me so I can help you change. And what I've come to understand is, the more I ask for God's help to help others, I have more power to help others through God, but I have quite simply so much power left over in my life that I'm juiced up in my whole occupations and affairs with God's help to solve whatever comes at me, right? You know, getting back to the concept of, you know, trying to pack more things through my life and trying to course correct my life to get slightly more money and slightly more this. Like you, I blow it up every time. But when I step back and say, okay, what's my role here? I was talking to Rob the other day. We're reading the big book. And, you know, talking about the actor, you know, going through life, trying to orient your life. Chris, it was 10 years before I realized the guy wasn't a director. He was an actor. I didn't get it from the very beginning because my mind doesn't work well, you know. I can go on forever, but, you know, you've been a good friend over the years. You helped me through that experience I had a couple of years ago. That, you know, it totally blew my mind, and I'm just grateful to be able to call my friend. Thank you for coming down.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you. Yeah. Chris, good to see you. It's been a long time. The first time I met you was in the union. It was at Peter's union.
Right, right.
Yeah, and then you came up and spoke at the How Why Is It For Us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was Grabs a few years ago. I'm going to ask you to come again this year.
Okay.
But it's really good seeing you. I, you know, I'm going to humble myself and get a little bit of humility here. But I had gone through the work of Matt Sobey, and I went through the work of Peter. And then, unfortunately, Matt and I parted. So I've been, like, kind of bouncing around without a sponsor. And I think God put me here tonight to meet you for a reason. We have to talk after this meeting, because after you go through this work, you get spoiled. You can't just get somebody to sponsor you that is not going to give you an answer. You have to know somebody that knows this book that can say, pull you on your shit. What are you doing with this? What are you doing with that? Are you acting like a tornado? I need that. I'm so glad I came tonight. Thank you. Thank you so much.
We're done. Okay. I think I have something to read here, right? Closing. In closing, we thank you for joining us tonight. From the Big Book, page 164, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. They knew a lot. Okay. That's humility. God will, sorry about that. Editorial. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But you obviously cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and all great events will come to pass for you and for countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past, give freely of what you find, and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Please remain seated while we end the meeting with our seven-step prayer, which is on page 76 of our book. We do not hold hands. That's good news, because the stomach flu is going around. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. All right. Thank you, everybody.